I've remembered to start it. And hopefully, I'll have everything figured out, but in the next 2 or 3 days at the most, you will get your podcasts. By the way, if you want any special artwork with them, let me know. Actually, though, this is something that Bill did. Do you want to say anything about how you did it? AVI function, and it will, is that what actually puts them all together into the movie? Okay, but it's actually pretty cool. This is effectively only a, you know, a point transformation, an intensity transformation, and that's pretty interesting. Yeah, nothing fancy. Yeah. You can see a vehicle every now and then go by. There is one thing that's really interesting here, which I will point out to you, and it's going to come up in today's lecture, and that is, we're not necessarily interested in edges everywhere in pictures like this. And if you stop and think, if you're a vehicle driving along, where are you interested in edges? It doesn't have to be everywhere. And when we talk about a different kind of filter, called a template matcher or a correlator, I think you'll get an idea that there may be some clever things that one can do. So let me pull that one out of the way, and just for sheer fun, what kind of filter did you use on that one? I'm not saying everyone's needs to look like that, but isn't that interesting? And of course, the windshield wipers always come up. Yeah, so we're seeing that. But notice that everything really of interest, at least for steering the vehicle in a lane, is probably very, very much dictated by the optics and the placement of the camera on the vehicle and stuff. And so, if you're really going to use vision to navigate, if it's just to follow a lane, you may not need to look everywhere. So, just something to think about. And let's see. I don't think I want to show you any more for a while. Let me just make sure that this thing... shut the thing down for a moment. There. Because I'm not planning on using it. Okay. By the way, did everyone get the picture of the Goodyear test track? Now that looks like a pretty nice track. Except for one minor thing. Hmm? Well, it's just south. I was thinking more of the other thing, which is that they don't plow it from, what is it, November through March or April? They don't plow it. Now, they have a bigger facility, which they use in the winter, that's in Texas. So, road trip. We just start it, let it go, we'll meet up with it in Texas. Now, that's true. That's true. We'll have refueling. Okay. Let me just get something here. Okay. Now, I want to tie a lot of little things in. Oh, I have to turn that thing on. Okay. I want to tie a couple things together here. Whoops. Wrong light switch. Talk some more about filters. Tell you about the MATLAB filter functions. Tell you about Gaussian filters. And a number of things. Okay? And then I'll come back to edge operators. But linear filters simply mean the output is proportional to the input. And basically, from our viewpoint, it means a filter that is a weighted sum of pixels. So that means all of the filters that we move across, where we multiply and sum, all of those are linear. Now, types of noise. We're going to see salt and pepper. Now, there's a very related type called impulse. Okay, salt and pepper is black and white noise. And I think maybe you noticed this in the pictures that I showed in class. It had black and white pixels. Okay, so it's noise that goes both ways. Impulse noise is just white. Now, from the viewpoint of noise that you might be picking up in the electrical system on a vehicle, anything from, for example, a car electrical system, as spark plugs, firing, etc., you might have some impulse type noise there. But this more appears when you use sensors which aren't integrated. Sensors which actually use photomultiplication, things like night vision systems. I have no idea what this thermal camera that we're going to test tomorrow is going to be like. It probably does not use these, but I don't know. And the one that we always see is Gaussian noise. And that is noise that has grayscale values. It has a distribution about a mean with a standard deviation. And you have to check your books. Sometimes the standard deviation is just a half width. Sometimes it's a full width. But this is the type of noise you get from ordinary electronics. This is the type of noise you get from normal sensors. So it's a good model. And I'm not going to prove it to you, but it turns out that linear smoothing filters are excellent at removing Gaussian noise. And the standard technique, and this is why I'm talking about it right now, you're probably wondering, why is he bringing up these Gaussian filters when we were talking about edge operators. This would normally come up in the chapter on Forgé, or frequency domain filtering, but we're doing a couple things out of sequence so that we can best tackle some of these homework problems. Usually the technique is to take your input filter, okay, then run an edge operator, and then threshold. That is a very standard technique. The idea is you run the edge operator, or rather, you run the filter. It's going to clean up the image, make the noise, well, reduce the noise. It doesn't really remove it. You want to do that typically before you run an edge operator, because what's an edge operator do? The derivative. We're going to find out that that's, in effect, a high-pass filter. Okay, if you look at it in the frequency domain. So if you can filter out high-frequency noise before you boost it, then you end up with something that's better. And like we saw in Bill's stuff, lots of times what you do is you'll take the output of this. At this point, it's, you know, 0 to 255 grayscale. 0 to 255 grayscale. Technically, what we normally call this, and this gets into what we're going to do in Chapter 12, in pattern recognition. What we have here is we don't have edges. We have a picture in which the edges have been emphasized by processing. What you then do is you might say, okay, anything in the derivative edge operator image, which is above 180, just picking that at random, anything above that is a candidate to be an edge. Okay, and technically what you usually do is you would get edge candidates here. And what happens is where we switch a lot from the image processing viewpoint to the computer vision viewpoint. And what you do is you say, oh, well, these edge candidates obviously form a line. This line forms a boundary that defines a road. I'm going to use that as my guide for driving. All of that stuff happens out there. Okay? But we're reducing, technically it's very similar to image compression or any other data compression algorithm. Now, mean filters, we've talked about these and there's really nothing to them. They're just an average. So for example, this would be a 3 by 3, if all it does. It turns out that that's not necessarily the best filter. It averages, it does get rid of noise. And you've always been told, I think, ever since you took your first engineering class, or your computer science class, or your math or statistics classes, average, and that gets rid of noise, right? The problem that you saw from the pictures that we showed a couple times in the class is if I average an image, and I start averaging a lot, all of my detail goes away. In fact, the ultimate average of an image is a grayscale. Uniform, just all the same gray. I just would average over and over again. And it turns out, for reasons I'm not going to prove, that Gaussian filters are really very, very good at removing Gaussian noise and keeping detail. Now, how do you produce a Gaussian filter? Well, it turns out, first of all, if you haven't already found it, the F special function in MATLAB will create one for you. I don't know what the corresponding thing in ImageJ is, but there's probably something there. And it turns out they're not very hard to create. Okay. Typically, you can approximate a Gaussian by Pascal's triangle. Just a binomial approximation. And you've probably seen this. And you can use these to create the coefficients of a Gaussian mask. Okay? Or you can do it mathematically as well. And basically, what is it? Well, first of all, it's a Gaussian distribution. Just like I drew over there. It's got a width, this sigma, and it's got an e to the minus 1 point, which is square root of 2, sigma, normalized to 1. And the standard way that you can do these, if you want, is to create a mask. This is a mask. And, hey, I could call it W. If you look at GWE, the Gonzales Woods Eddins book, and by the way, chapter 3 has a lot of stuff. I don't know if anyone's looked at the reference section of the webpage. In GWE, chapter 3 talks about how you actually implement all of this stuff in MATLAB, and has tons of examples. Very nice. But anyway, basically, each element of a mask, whether it be 3x3, or you don't have to make them necessarily square, but you can just compute it, where I and J are going to be the coordinates in here, and we would be centering it. Okay? And you can do something now. The parameters are sigma, which specifies the width, and if you stop and think about it, the bigger you make sigma, what happens is the more and more it approaches an averaging filter. As you make sigma smaller and smaller, the exact opposite occurs. In fact, in the limit, it does nothing. You just keep the value at the middle, and there's nothing that's contributed from around it. So no averaging occurs when sigma equals zero. Total averaging occurs when sigma equals infinity, and you'll usually do something in the middle. The default, by the way, in MATLAB, is one-half. So, and I'll tell you how you can specify this, but you can actually, I mean, you can just do this by hand. You can do this with a trivial little computer program. There's only one thing. Once you compute the elements, you know, maybe for a 5x5 or whatever, and you can see the numbers don't get very big, but I didn't mention the K, and that's just the normalized constant. And by that, I mean, if you want to do something like this. We did the 1/9 here, so the grayscales would stay within the original 0 to 255. If we don't watch it, we'll have the same thing happen here. What is the value for K? Well, basically, it's nothing more than the sum over I and J of all of the elements. Now, the exponential is a non-integer function. So what you can often do is once you just compute this, okay, pick your smallest value you want, and then basically you're normalizing on in terms of the smallest value. So if your elements came out, oh, I don't know what, maybe 70. Since we don't have a constant in it, it'd be 1 for the moment. So we'd have our 1, and then maybe 5.3. And since it's
it is symmetric.
And in this case, he picked a point 3. Norm redefined that as 1, that it divide everything by point 3, so that all of the values would be multiples. And then it's above 1, and, you know, that would look like a 1.5 over point 3. Okay, you know, you've got a 1 point something. Is it a 2? Maybe. This would become a 3, and so you'd have it renormalized in terms of the closest integer values. And then you sum all of those up to get your value for k. Actually, there'd be 1 over the sum out here. So this is how you can make your own Gaussian filter. And it doesn't have to be, as you can tell, a perfect match to a Gaussian curve. This is not that particular. The key thing is simply how wide the narrow. The smaller it is, the better you will keep detail. It is the narrower. The wider it is, the more you will get average out of noise, but the more you'll lose detail. Now, some good things about this, which come in from the last time, maybe you remember. When we were talking about the Laplacian, one of the things that we talked about was, okay, you can have one that's very sensitive to vertical and horizontal. You can make another one that's sensitive to the diagonals. This is rotation with symmetric. So it does it. Whatever it filters equally well. You know, it's not going to emphasize or de-emphasize any images. There's some stuff that I won't get into, but we'll come back and visit when we're in the frequency domain. But does anyone know what the Fourier transform of Gaussian is? Okay, the Fourier transform of Gaussian is a Gaussian. And it turns out the bigger you make it in the frequency domain, the smaller you make it in the spatial domain, and vice versa. Okay, and we're not going to worry too much about it, but it also turns out that this is a separable filter. We might talk about that more in frequency domain, but what it means is I can do a X Gaussian filter and a Y Gaussian filter and take the product of them. It's sort of like, and we haven't done it yet, I can represent a two-dimensional Fourier transform as the product of two one-dimensional. So it can make things faster. But I just wanted to let you know about that. We'll pick that back up in Chapter 4. We're sort of driving ourselves, as I said, more about the projects. Now, I recommend GWE Chapter 3, Spatial Filtering. And it's in the reference section of our webpage. Basically, I particularly recommend that you look at two functions in it. IMFilter, which is the two-dimensional spatial filtering function built into MATLAB, and you use it in the following way. It's got an output image, G. Okay, typically this will be a square matrix. Okay, we've got the IM filter function. And it's got a lot of inputs, some of which are optional. Input. Okay, now normally all of these are going to be 8-bit bytes, unit 8. So when you look at, you know, the display of variables in MATLAB, I don't know what it does if you just put in numbers, you know, a matrix or something. You'll probably get a ton of error messages. W is what I call mask or the template. That's, I guess I erased it, but that's usually our 3x3, 5x5, 9x9. That's that two-dimensional array of numbers. And it turns out MATLAB has a function to calculate that for you. It makes it pretty easy. Okay. Filtering mode. I don't think this is optional. There are two modes. Correlation, convolution. And let me just ask, does anyone in here know the difference between them? Okay, don't worry. This comes out of something that's back in signals and systems. And I don't know if you've ever looked at a correlation interval. Basically, a correlation is nothing more than a dust product. Okay? That's really basically all it is. It is integrated, of course, over all the components of the vector. Convolution looks, mathematically, looks very, very similar to correlation, except we flip. Yes. You flip it. Okay. Well, all of our stuff is 3x3, and it's symmetric. To us, it almost makes no difference which one we use, although we will potentially have some use for correlation later on. You know what you're looking for. Correlation is a useful tool, but most of the time, you want to be convolution. Right now, you won't get in any trouble if you put it backwards. Now, these, I think, are all optional functions now. There's a boundary conditions and a sum. And then psi, optional. So, usually you'll stop right there. Well, of course, put your parentheses to close that. Now, boundary conditions, I've alluded to them, and they're going to come out more when we do frequency domain. Okay, and there's a couple here. There's replicate. Okay, the real big question here is, remember, when we talked about an image, and let's suppose we're starting with our mass way up here at the origin, and maybe that's a 3x3. Okay. You see, it sticks out over the edge of the image. The question is, what do you do around the image? Okay. Replicate simply replicates these pixels that way. In effect, it sort of sticks out an extra row or two, or however many are needed, based on the size of your mass. Okay. And that works perfectly fine. Okay. Then there's symmetrical. Symmetrical. Okay. This would just go out with the same values with the replicate. What the symmetric does is it actually mirrors about the edge. So this value here would be the same as that. This one would be the same as that. So it really is a mere reflection the whole way around the edge. And there's actually another one, okay, which is called circular. And what that one is take this image and duplicate it. In other words, there's n by n array, or actually there's an infinite 2D array of this image over and over again. And that gets important when you talk about discrete Fourier transforms and stuff. But for our purposes right now, replicate's fine. You might even want to try playing with these to see the effect, but it will only happen around the edges. Okay? It's not going to be anywhere else. Oh, and size, the default is the same, and that means that the output is the same size as the input. But I think both of these are optional, with replicate and the same being the default. Okay, now, there shouldn't be any difficulty for you to come up with an input image. We provide enough of those in here. We're interested in your output image. There's not very many choices on filtering mode, so all we need is math. And MATLAB comes to the rescue again. we have a function in MATLAB for generating mass. And by the way, if there are similar functions in ImageJ that you've discovered, let me know. You know, I'm sure they would have that. But I'm going to be curious whether, for example, they have the mass generator. Yeah, you know, one thing you might have to do is use MATLAB to generate your mass and then run it in ImageJ. Or do it like I just did here by hand. The masks aren't really very hard. But it turns out there's a second function called fspecial, described in GWB, page 99. And also, you can just type in, help fspecial or whatever, and get it. But it's useful for generating W. And basically, it's got two parameters. Well, actually, I shouldn't say parameters. It's got two arguments, type and then a list of parameters. And the list of parameters are the constants that it needs to generate a filter of different types. For example, for this, if you wanted to do a Gaussian in single quotes tells it that you want to construct a W that corresponds to the mass for doing a Gaussian filtering operation. And you tell it, for the Gaussian, the arguments are, how big do you want it to be? Square brackets, and you could put in 9 by 9. You could put in 3 by 3. You don't have to put it in. If you don't put it in, the default is 3 by 3. Okay, and there's a sigma which you can put in following that. And the default on that is 1/2. So it'll generate the mass for you. Now, it turns out that there's a whole bunch of these. There's a table on page 99, I think it is, and I'm not going to go through all of them. But there is a prewit, which I'm going to tell you about 10 minutes. Maybe not even that long. There's a Sobel, which is, by the way, when in doubt, a Sobel edge operator is a really good one. It works very well under most conditions. There's a Laplacian, an average. The average doesn't really do too much. It's sort of like all ones, normalized, but it's really not a very complicated one. And I haven't told you much about Unsharp, and maybe we'll get to that at the end of today, and there's a couple more. But basically, this just automatically generates the mask for you. So this is really pretty nice. You know, for this stuff, MATLAB does make it really easy. Okay. So let me know if ImageJ has as many of those, as many little goodies as those. I don't know if it does, but I haven't used it yet. By the way, I did find one more textbook that uses ImageJ, and unfortunately it's in German. So it's a ways, it's not ready for the U.S. market yet. Yeah, if you can read German, it's pretty good, but there's a full textbook on ImageJ in German. Okay, but like I said, the masks are really very easy to generate. This is not a big deal. By the way, one of the things that also will come up, if you think about it, if you're going to do, and I erased it, if you're going to do something like, for example, a Gaussian filter followed by an edge operator, why do two filtering operations? Just add the two masks together and apply that to your image. You know, there's no sense in doing more work or more mathematical computations real time than you have to. Yes? Yeah, you may have to renormalize, but yeah. If you stop and think about it, what am I doing? I apply it to the image, and then I come along and apply it. Think about it. I'll let you think about it, but you can combine to get the mass. Now, more operators. And we want to get out of the mode of derivative operators, but we're going to finish up a few things on derivative operators. Okay. Basically, edge operators. I think I actually made my first point here when I talked about the filtering, the derivative operator, the thresholding, and that is that an edge operator detects local edges. It only operates within that neighborhood. It doesn't know anything that's alongside it. This computation that I made here, the cubic edge, this value is independent of this one, is independent of that one. We haven't done the global stuff. We just tie them all together to make a real edge. You know, what we've done, even though it's involved, pixels around it, is we're still doing point-by-point things. And so it's very localized. Okay? Now, types. Number one, approximations of gradients. And by that, I really mean all derivatives. Two is template match. And this is very, very interesting. And this might actually be very applicable to driving a vehicle down the road looking at lane lines or lane markers. If you know the shape of something, you may as well use that information. We'll talk about that. That's a big topic. And the third one, which fits actually into what I was saying, where most edge operators are detecting local edges, okay, curve fitting operations. This is not something we're going to do. That is not real time. People that do really, really precision stuff, what they'll do is they'll take all of the grayscale information. You know, they might take a whole row. Maybe you'll have 20, 30, 100 pixels. What they'll do is they'll fit usually a polynomial, but it doesn't have to be. They'll fit something to it. And maybe they'll do a function like that. They use Chebyshev polynomials. They use all kinds of things. And if you have, then, something that's fit to a lot of data, you know, mathematically, then I can say, okay, halfway up this curve is where the edge is. And you see, I'm not exactly taking the derivative. I'm doing it basically at the fit. This is when you want real high precision measurements like industrial metrology, interferometers, stuff like that. Now, we'll sort of do one and two, but not three. Three usually gets saved for a computer vision course. We're going to look at the history now. And it fits into one and two Roberts operators. These are the first. They look exactly like a gradient. and I think I've drawn them in class 4. And notice, they're diagonal. Okay? They're only 2x2. Well, they're not even really quite 2x2s. They're sort of 1x2s. But it's in a 2x2 space. And very earliest, very sensitive to noise. If you remember the last time when I was doing the first derivative operator, notice what I did was I took one horizontal, a second horizontal, and then I was immediately averaging the two. And when we went from those 2x2s, in essence, to the 3x3s, we're really doing more averaging. So the bigger you make these, the less noise. So the solution is you do local averaging. And this is what shows up in a whole class of operators by different names. The first one, which I'll mention because it's in MATLAB stuff, is the prelim. And instead of just doing a 2x2 like we did, it's a 3x3. Okay, so it's just averaging over a larger area. Okay, Robert's the only one that's a 2x2. Technically, those are. And these are XY, and needless to say, there's a corresponding, since that detects edges horizontally, there's a corresponding one that detects edges vertically. And this is where that the idea of approximations of gradients comes in, because gradients usually have corrections. The Laplacian doesn't. Now, the one that, to be honest, almost everyone uses is the Sobel. And it is a center-weighted 3x3. And it works very well. And in fact, Pratt at USC did some analysis, and it shows that it actually performs much better than a bunch of these other operators. Now, these came out of the idea of you're computing the derivative with that mass, that operator. We're going to look at two, which are totally different. We're going to look at Kirsch and Treichen. And both of them do different things. Kirsch is going to be our first template person. And the idea is, and it's really more like correlation. We're going to come up with a set of mass which look like edges. Okay? And if you stop and think, well, let me draw a couple of these. These are the easy ones, and you'll notice they look a lot like Roberts to start with. Okay, the idea is if I take these and slide them over the image, what's going to happen? Well, I get a value at every point. Where do I get the largest value when these match what the image is doing? Okay, this is, again, that dot product type thing, if you think of it in terms of vectors. But basically, you get the most value, the largest response, when these match. Now, those are a little too small. So, take the larger ones. And if you, and these are starting to now to look like, this is the way an edge might look like. And you're going to say, oh, well, this doesn't look any different than Prewitt stuff. Okay, well, here's where we start to make the difference. And by the way, all of these things are in the notes. Okay, we'll take care of the diagonals. That's a model of a 45-degree edge. You know, that's not the way any of our Laplacian, that's not the way any of our stuff sort of came up looking. And we can do the same thing in the other direction. And you can now immediately think about it. Okay, if I take this and I slide it over my image, when I get something that matches this, that's when I will get the largest output value. And that's where I run these over, just like the spatial filter, threshold, get the appropriately, get the largest values, and bang, that's where I have my edge candidates. And these get just bigger and bigger. And it's just more and more statistics, and I'm not going to do all of them. And these are just all minus ones, and these are just all ones. And you can do them in the same four cardinal directions. Now, we're not finished. That's just the response, okay? How do you implement it? Okay, and this is now the Kirchhoff function. And you can describe it very elegantly. The output at any point in the image X is going to be equal to the maximum of 1 or the maximum of the sum of the differences magnitude. And the whole idea is the following. These k's here in the sum correspond to different templates. The templates correspond in turn to edges, which are in the following directions. So there's X, any point in the image, and 0 would correspond to one like this, an edge going that way. 1 would correspond to an edge going this way. Okay, and you see what we're trying to do is we're going to compute the difference there, okay, find the one which has the largest response that gives us a direction, okay, and a value. If it's not above a certain threshold, we don't use the directionality at all and ignore it. Okay, so this is on the basis of templates. Now, I will say, there's nothing that says you have to pick templates that look like this. You can make it big. And if you knew your angle, you could have templates that correspond to the right angle for edges. Or I guess if you made it big enough, you could have a V-shaped one. But you can design templates that look at particular angles. Okay, so that's the idea there. Now, Free Chin took a totally different viewpoint, and Free Chin's approach actually applies to color. And the people at Carnegie Mellon were using it for a while on the old NAV lab. Okay. Free Chen were, the two of them were more mathematically inclined than Kirsch. Okay. And what they did is they came up with a set of orthogonal basis functions. Okay. Now, I don't know if you remember your M4 very much, or your linear algebra course, or anything, but if you remember things like Fourier series, you know, under certain conditions you can completely describe the function as sum of these functions, and each function then has a coefficient. Okay? Well, instead of having sines and cosines, like you have for one of those, there's other mathematical ways that you can come up with basis functions. And it turns out that if you have a 3 by 3, this is only an example. You can expand it to 5 by 5, 9 by 9, whatever. You can mathematically generate things. And turns out for a 9 by 9, you have to have 9 basis functions. And no matter what you have, it can then be described as a set of coefficients times each one of the basis functions. Absolutely. You can't not have that happen. And so he mathematically said, okay, what is a set of basis functions for a 3x3? And these are pretty interesting. Okay, that was his k equals 0, k equals 1. That one actually looks a little bit like a funny Sobel. You notice? 1, square root of 2, 1, it's center weighted. It's not quite the same as the Sobel, but somewhat. But the others don't look quite the same. I mean, this one looks very funny. But it's a basis function. And you can keep going, and you'll get basis functions of all types. Now, the key idea is, instead of having my original image at each point, I rewrite the image as the sum of the basis functions. So, if those are your basis functions, and the shift is in here just to represent the fact that I mathematically talk about these in their own coordinate system, but what are we doing? We slide it around throughout the whole image. That's why we've got x minus x naught. So x is the local coordinate system. And I show my quantum mechanics background using, I always like using broad cat notation. This is the dot product of this vector multiplied by itself. Okay, it's just normalization. You don't need to worry too much, but that's just normalization. Basically, this is the coefficient that I was talking about right here. That's actually how you would compute it. And so, okay, if it can always be represented like that, think about the following. Not all of those basis functions represent edges. In fact, for example, this is, of the ones I've drawn, the only one that represents an edge. It looks like an edge. Okay. Negative there, positive there, on the bottom. Okay. So it looks like an edge. None of the rest of these are. So the idea is, what is the total energy at each point, x naught, and it would be the sum of the coefficients. OK? okay, this is sort of a standard way. If you work with Fourier series, we do it. But it's simply nothing more than the coefficients squared. Energy is always squared. So for a 3x3, that's the total energy at a point in the picture. Now, the new concept is what's the edge energy? Well, it's the same thing, but only for the ones that look like edges. And it turns out that there was one that looked like this, and then there was one that was rotated 90 degrees. Okay. Those are the only two, so we define the edge energy. And the edge energy is just the sum over the two. I forget what they are, what their numbers were. But there's only two of them. So you see, I think you can sort of see what I'm going to be leading up to. This is the edge energy. Energy is usually in an image thought of as just how much does it move around? How much does the gray level change? Okay? But it's, we think, we just multiply, we just square the value, okay, and add them up. So we have a total energy, an edge energy. What's a good way to find an edge? How about that we look at the ratio of the energy? Okay, we look at I use the same term for each. Okay. So what's the ratio of the edge energy to the total energy? Basically, it's saying if it looks a lot like this, or if it looks a lot like this, and there's not much other stuff going on, then it's probably an edge. And by the way, this was based upon looking at human perception. And do we, in our eyes, or in our neural processing, actually filter out edges? And that's sort of what this is leading up to. And I won't get into it very much, but Freechen did a lot of other stuff, and what they said is, leaving at that point is bad. Okay? Although they got a paper out of that. But leaving it at that point isn't enough. And the reason is, if you just look at E and S, what you can do if you set a threshold T is you can lose weak edges. Okay? Like I might have something that's there. You know, if I just set a threshold on the edge energy by itself, I might have a low, you know, there's a fair bit of edgeness there. But I can have strong and weak edges. And that's not good. Because if I have a dim area, or a bright area of the screen, or of the picture, I have a weak edge. Yes. Well, actually, that's what this does. And we do a diagonal line. Okay, and you're exactly right. And now, so that would be conventional thresholding. And we do a diagonal line. And this works very well. I can have large values, small values, but it's circular. So again, I can pick up now the weak edges. It's not that they're low in edge energy. They're just low in energy. And that's where a conventional thresholding scheme would ignore them. Okay. Now, I'm not expecting anyone to be doing anything like that, and let me tell you, you don't have the time to do it. I mean, these are not things which are fast. You know, these work great if you're, well, if you're in computer vision, robotics, and all that, and you don't have real time. This is okay. Okay? Also, if you're interpreting images, you know, if you download something like Google Satellite or something, you really want to process it on, you know, I don't know what, all of those Korean missile sites or something, you can sit there and run big computers for a long time. No problem. Now, again, we're not going to say anything about it, but I can take all of these, by the way, and turn them into three dimensions. Instead of X and Y, I add a Z. And you can imagine, I've got three-dimensional operators. Now, we're not going to use that very much. Actually, we're not going to use it at all in here. But if you do CT, if you do MRI, people that do that kind of stuff are interested in three-dimensional images. And think about what a three-dimensional edge operator looks like. And by the way, this is where orthogonal basis functions and stuff are going to come in color. What's a color edge? Is it just a change in one color? And it's really a change in a color space that's three-dimensional. And one way to do it is to look at template. Is to look at an orthogonal basis function expansion. But there's all kinds of ways of doing color. Now, I'll tell you one result, and then I think I'm going to stop with this particular topic. And Pratt, who is the director of the Image Processing Institute at the University of Southern Cal, came up with a figure of merit. In other words, how good are each of these edge operators at coming up with the edge operator? And I'm not going to get into all of the details. There's some normalization. But the key thing is it looks at all of the candidate edge points in a picture. And it has something like this for each one. Okay. This is the distance between where an edge was found and where it really was. This is just a penalty function. Okay. And what's interesting is that you can actually, and he plotted these on all kinds of pictures, and you'll find these in the literature, mostly of tanks and military trucks, and you can guess where he was getting his funding. But it's all worked out very nicely, and the higher the number is, the better. H squared to sigma squared, I didn't write it down, but I know that's a signal-to-noise ratio. The more the cleaner the images, the better. And the Prewitt and Sobel work pretty well. They go like that. So if you have a really good, clean image, no noise, strong contrast, works very well. The Roberts actually goes something like that. You know, and it's only when you're really trying to push out the max performance that you go to things like Gaussians, you start making it more and more complicated. And in the middle are, and we didn't talk about these, Huckels. Okay, the Prewitt and Sobels are derivatives. The Roberts is a gradient, and the Huckel is a model. The Huckle is more like the Kirsch. Okay. But the Sobel works very doggone well. I don't know how many of you have already discovered Sobel or found Sobel in your filters, but it works pretty good. And in fact, when in doubt, use it. Okay. Actually, we're just... Let's see if we can do this. If I do it right, I can wrap up. Chapter 3. But that was the stuff that I think is particularly relevant to your assignment. Filters. Edge operators. Okay? Now we go pick up the book. We'll use about 6 or 7 pages of the book. And then I'm going to skip off onto another tangent. We're going to be starting geometry next week. We're going to be talking about warps. We're going to be talking about later... Not warp drive, by the way. Not Star Trek type stuff. That's in another course. That's probably in the physics department. We're going to do things like image rectification. Given that I've got an image that doesn't look square or rectangular, how do I fix it up so it is? And I just wanted to show you a couple pictures in here. Okay, this is where we actually took our tangent. If you remember way back when, this is where we started talking about derivatives. And I think you really know most of the stuff in some of the following slides. We have digital Laplacian, and notice, sometimes they have negative centers, sometimes they have positive centers. They're flipped around. Why in the world might you want to do that? It depends on what you're going to do with it. If you're going to subtract it from something, you may as well multiply it by the -1, take care of all of the operations at the same time. And this is an example of doing that. I actually showed you this way, I think, the first lecture, the second lecture, but it now makes more sense. This is the original image. Okay? This is now the image using a Laplace. I think it's a 3x3 Laplace. I can't remember what the kernel is. And notice, you can see where it picks up a lot of little detail, even on this, you can see it. It doesn't show up very well, because what happens when you run something like a Laplacian? And if you remember some of the values for the Laplacians, 4, 8 stuff, it doesn't guarantee that the result will be in a 0 to 255 range. Okay? This doesn't necessarily carry a scaling constant along with it. So, it moves it around in the image. That is a dark image. You can shift it. This is just shifting it to show it better on the screen. We made it brighter, maybe with a little more contrast. And what you do to enhance images, and this is where you talk about sharpening, basically you add this to this. And you've got to watch your normalization again. But it's just to make it look good. Humans like pictures that have sharpness, sharp details in them. And so, when you see all of those little things about unsharp masking stuff, that's part of what's going on. Now this one, yes? And it depends on how it's done, and in fact, I'll show you it in a slide coming up. It turns out there's a coefficient in there, and the question is how much does it actually do, and how large is the kernel? And I don't know, usually Photoshop has so many options that you can change anything, but I don't know that I've seen the arguments for changing the sharpening. But there's probably something in there. This one is actually, though, really interesting. I didn't catch it originally, but let's see. We have two Laplacians, and one of them doesn't contain diagonals, and one does contain the diagonals. And let's see. D... This is the original. This is now processed with this Laplacian operator. Okay? And this picture is one that has a lot of information at a diagonal, lots of edges at a diagonal. This is now processed with a Laplacian with a diagonal term, with diagonal terms. Look. Those edges are much, much, much nicer. And in fact, one of the arguments, and I should have done it, put it over here on the side, it might be nice to do the one that only has the diagonal terms. Because, for example, like in our vehicle, where we're looking at stuff that looks sort of triangular, maybe we're only interested in the diagonal terms. Okay. Now... this is where you get into masking, okay? And we're not going to have super much time. And what goes on with masking is what I showed you in the earlier one where... put it back there. What we were doing is we were adding the derivative to the original image. That's all masking is about. Well, there's other things called masking, but... okay, you can do positive or negative Laplacians, and what gets much more interesting, and it shows up here, is I'm actually run over a tiny bit, but we get different kinds of masking. This is sharpening. Okay. This will, by the way, get to your question. This is unsharp masking. And the idea is the unsharp masked image is the original image minus the average. This is precisely where some of your blurring is coming in, because you're subtracting off a blurred version. Now, it depends on what the image is like, but if it doesn't have too much detail, then you're subtracting off the average. What does it leave? The high-frequency information, the edges. That's what it's supposed to do. It doesn't always do its job, and I'll do one tiny thing and explain it the next time. We can do a high-frequency boost, where you take the original image, multiply it by some constant, and subtract off the average. Okay? And that actually relates to adding and subtracting the Laplacian. This, it's not obvious how the Laplacian comes in. This is not immediately obvious, but on Tuesday it will be. Okay. So, I assume you're going to work all weekend on navigating vehicles. Oh, you should really be thinking about navigating vehicles. And next Thursday, we will have our special speaker that will come in and talk about high-speed, real-time vision for finding lines in images. And your homework is due Tuesday. And I keep working on the website. You'll keep getting emails. I should have your assignments back actually tonight. And I'll look at whether I can just fit them in my door, and I'll try uploading the grades to Blackboard so that you don't necessarily have to come by.